Okay, meeting will come to order. This is Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs today on March 30th. Apologize for the late start here. The Environment Finance Committee was in here late this morning. Luckily, though, we don't have to be out of here right at noon. On the other days, we usually have session right at noon, and today it's later in the day, so we'll probably go a few minutes after noon today. Members, thank you for your cooperation in meeting first deadline Tuesday night. I'm glad we weren't here till midnight. It was nice to get out at a decent hour. I think it was around 9:30 Tuesday night. So we met first deadline with our bills, and as is traditional, there typically is not as many bills between first and second deadline, and second deadline is next Tuesday night at midnight. You can see on the agenda we have four bills up today. My intention is with the last bill, that is our legislative reform bill. We're going to hear that, look at some amendments, and then we'll be laying that over and continuing it next Tuesday, so that by Tuesday evening we'll have a final bill that will come out of here. And so we are not meeting Friday. We're not meeting tomorrow this week. And it looks like we don't need to meet on Monday night. So it's just today and then Tuesday during our regular committee time. And possibly one more time after that if we get some other bills or something. We're looking at some redistricting issues potentially that won't move this year, but just want to get some airing before next year. And what's there, Lafa around? I know we're looking at potentially a joint dinner with the Senate committee next Tuesday night, so we'll get you some more details on that, but if you could maybe pencil that in your schedule next Tuesday, April 4th in the evening, that we might be meeting with the Senate committee that matches up with our committee. There's cookies going around, and we'll have some announcements here at the end of the meeting related to that as well, and I know we have some guests visiting with us in the audience. And they're from the Plainview FFA from Plainview, Minnesota. So let's welcome them. All right, great.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Yes, I'd just like to recognize my hometown FFA chapter, the Plainview FFA chapter. They're up here for FFA Day on the Hill, promoting agriculture, and not only that, promoting education as well as many other issues. And thank you for welcoming them.
Great. Well, thank you. All right. Well, we'll get started with Representative Beard's bill. And first, let's do the minutes, though. Yeah, Representative Haas.
I've read the minutes and find them in order for Tuesday, March 28th, and Monday, March 27th minutes, and I
okay.
Move they be approved.
Thank you. And actually, we'll take those in two separate motions. Representative Haas approves the moves that the minutes of the March 27th meeting be approved. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and those minutes are approved. And Representative Haas also approves the minutes of the March 28th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion overwhelmingly is approved on that one. Okay. You can tell we're getting to the end of our committee time here, close to second deadline. All right, let's get going with Representative Beard. I saw him a minute ago. Doesn't he know you can't leave the room when you... Okay. Sheldon, why don't you hop in the testifier seat there as we're waiting for Representative Beard. We'll do his bill second. Do you have testifiers that are here?
They're doing.
Okay, well, let's get them up then. Okay. So we'll do the second bill first. And I see there's a delete everything amendment to that. Okay. Representative Johnson, welcome to your committee. And would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you very much.
So, Representative Sheldon Johnson moves that House File 3139 be recommended to be to pass and be re-referred to the Regulated Industries Committee. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
And your bill is before us. Would you like to get the delete everything on the bill?
Yes, I would like to move it.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves the DE1 amendment, which is a delete everything, to put the bill in the shape that he would like. Any discussion on that? All in favor of the DE-1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE-1 amendment is on the bill. Representative Johnson, your bill is in front of us as amended. Please present it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill that has had several revisions as it has moved forward in the Senate and as we've met with a variety of stakeholders, including the Department of Commerce, the Department of Administration, MNSCU, and architects. I'm going to speak briefly about the Section 1 of the bill, and then I have several testifiers who are going to talk briefly about Section 2 and Section 3 of this particular bill. Section 1 is the part that I've probably been most involved with, and what it entails is the following. The purpose of this section and subdivision 2 specifically is to set forth guidelines and procedures that building projects funded with state bonds produce no net increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, this initiative builds on existing law, which are known as the sustainable building guidelines, that bond-funded buildings exceed the state energy code by 30%. So that's already in state law, that bond-funded buildings exceed the state energy code by 30%, and this initiative that you have before you builds on that particular current law. Now, the guidelines and procedures, I just want to give you a little context of what this would look like. The guidelines and procedures would likely incorporate two major components so you have some sense of how these procedures would actually play out. What you do is, first of all, number one, calculate the projected energy consumption of the new building that is being constructed with state bonds. And energy use would include the energy used in generating electricity, heating, hot water production, air conditioning, and so forth. And once energy consumption estimates are known, then the greenhouse gas calculations can be made. The second aspect or major component would be to offset those greenhouse gas emissions of the new construction by reducing emissions from existing buildings. And typically the offset would come and occur through energy efficiency improvements or possibly even purchasing renewable energy within the state. So what we have before us, members, is climate neutral bonding is what we call it, and it's one important global warming solution that we can take on the state level. And I just want to emphasize it's been a very collaborative effort by a variety of stakeholders, again, from Department of Commerce, Department of Administration, all on board with this, architects and MNSCU. And a couple testifiers now will speak to Section 2 and 3, and we also have John Bailey who wants to just briefly give an overview of the bill as well.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Who's going to start here? Please identify yourself for the record.
Linda Kane with the Department of Administration, State Architect's Office. We are presently tracking 25 pilot projects, all of them in various stages of design. And by extending this assessment authority, it will allow us to continue to track these buildings through construction and commissioning. It would give us very valuable information. As well as that, this additional funding would allow us to continue to improve the guidelines. We're constantly getting feedback from the consultants as they use the guidelines, and so this would allow us to continue to refine them. I'd like David Ajadi to speak to what this assessment would allow us to continue to do in terms of benchmarking all of the existing buildings, which is also a part of this. It was also funded by the same assessment.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm David Ajadi. I live at 312 Spring Street, St. Paul, Minnesota. And we have been working with the Departments of Administration and Commerce on this. To date, we've benchmarked 2,000 buildings that are publicly owned in Minnesota. We've really focused on the big users, the folks who have between 20 and 100 buildings in their portfolio. And there are 3,600 buildings left to benchmark. The purpose of the benchmarking is to fundamentally find a good list. We jokingly refer to it as the good list of bad buildings. But really those buildings that are in most need of energy conservation, energy improvement, and the like. The reason is that if you had money to spend on improving the population of buildings and you didn't know which were the good ones and which were the poor ones, you might get a certain return on your investment. But when you know which ones really need the most work, you can double your return on investment. And that's the purpose for benchmarking. And that's the part that of this that we'd like to be able to complete.
Okay, and you have another testifier. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is John Bailey. I'm with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Minneapolis, and thank you for having this hearing on this piece of legislation. I know your schedules are busy. One thing I wanted to mention about this, these sections 2 and 3, I think it's important to note that this isn't state money we're talking about. It is a pass-through via the PUC to electric and gas utilities. So it's an assessment. It's not an appropriation from the state government. So in addressing climate-neutral bonding, I'd just like to say that this performance standard will challenge architects and engineers to design buildings that minimize energy use and lower operating costs in existing buildings and in new buildings. It will encourage the use of Minnesota's vast resources of renewable energy. And high-performance buildings meeting the standard and designed to Minnesota's sustainable building guidelines will save taxpayers money over the long term by lowering the operating costs of these buildings. And there's news every day now, I'm sure you get it, about providing more and more evidence and warnings that we must take actions today to reduce our global warming pollution. And I'm here to encourage Minnesota to start becoming a leader in this area. The public is behind you. Poll after poll indicates broad public support on government taking action to address climate change. And this proposal before you would provide a modest but meaningful step in the right direction. This proposal has not been adopted anywhere else that I'm aware of, but you are starting to see examples out there in the world that are complementary or similar. Mayors in 220 cities around the country have signed on to the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, which commits their communities to reduce greenhouse gases by 7% from 1990 levels by 2012. It's a kind of Kyoto Protocol on the local level. Seven northeastern states have agreed to reduce their global warming emissions by 10% by 2019. California is currently in various stages of debate. Some policies have been enacted, but they're debating about 40 different policies to enable them to reach a goal to reduce their emissions in California by 80%. From 1990 levels by 2050. Oregon's governor announced recently that he wants the state to purchase 100% renewable electricity for all their state buildings. Seattle's municipal electric utility announced last fall that they had become the first utility to be climate neutral. And in terms of their electricity production, that means every one of their customers is now climate neutral in terms of their electricity use. And there are other examples. The private sector is getting involved. Climate neutral is becoming kind of a catchphrase out there in the world of energy and buildings, and it should be something that the state of Minnesota takes a close look at. This bill would, as Representative Johnson described, it would take a look at the building's energy use, and meeting a climate neutral performance standard would result in energy efficiency being the primary way to reduce greenhouse gases. But efficiency can only really get you so far these days, and so the buildings are going to have an energy profile that will result in some emissions being generated, and those emissions will have to be offset. And as David and Linda said, this benchmarking process that's going on in identifying the energy profiles of our state buildings, that represents an incredible storehouse of CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions offset opportunities that the state new buildings can use to apply to their offsets for the new buildings. And these new buildings could also rely on renewable energy they could purchase green pricing electricity from the electric utilities in the state, which are mandated by law to provide such an option for customers. And I will note just briefly that in Colorado, Xcel Energy's customers that are participating in their renewable energy program actually pay less per month than customers that don't participate. And that is because if you participate in the renewable energy program, you are exempted from paying any fossil fuel surcharges on your bill. And in Colorado at the moment, because they rely a great deal more than we do here on natural gas, those surcharges are actually higher than the premium price you pay for the renewable electricity. And other ways to get offsets could be owning renewable energy projects like wind or solar, changing your fleet vehicles to use renewable fuels, and so on. You're seeing a lot of creative ideas out there on how to do offsets, even partnering with the private sector in some cases. So I expect if this bill or if this policy is enacted, you'll see an incredible amount of creativity from the architectural and engineering community on how to meet the standard. And that's all I have to say, and I appreciate your time. And Madam Chair, I will say Joel Shirky and Stefan Tanner would have liked to be here, but they couldn't be here, and I know you know them, and they're green architects.
Great, thank you. Representative Johnson, I have a question for you or one of your testifiers. With the bill as it came in and then with the delete off, can you just kind of explain the progression there, and does it have something to do with matching up with the Senate language? You can just describe what happened there. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, we're trying to match up as best possible with the Senate language, simply put.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Questions for Representative Johnson or the testifiers? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson and our guests. I just think this is a great proposal, but I wanted to say for a variety of us who served on the Ford Building Renovation Committee, in our discussion with some of the architects who volunteered to be on that from the community, that building actually could meet it by having a green roof, I believe, because it, unlike modern buildings, was built to like last forever and actually can handle the weight of a grain roof, which a lot of renovation projects haven't. So that might be, even in the Capitol complex, we might have a model moving forward.
Good. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'm glad this bill came forward because I was feeling pretty laid back this morning. This one gets me kind of cranked up. First of all, let me just ask a financial question. In Subdivision 3 in the Delete All Amendment, under Section 2, bottom of page 1, maybe for Representative Johnson, lines 1.30 and on. Describe the section of law that triggers this assessment appropriation. Is that the same one that we fund the Electrical Energy Task Force from, or is this a different appropriation?
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Bailey here will direct the answer to that question.
Okay.
Mr. Bailey.
Madam Chair, Representative. The subdivision, or the Section 2 of the delete of the language that's being modified comes from the statute that created the Reliability Administrator. That's Ken Wolf's position at the PUC, or Department of Commerce, whichever, wherever he's at. And so I don't know the history of why this funding for the Sustainable Building Guidelines was inserted in that particular statute, but that's where this language is coming from.
Follow up, Representative
Beard. Madam Chair and Mr. Bailey, is that funding stream sufficient to handle up to an extra $500,000 a year that's required here under this subdivision? Or are they going to have to change that fee structure, do you know?
Mr. Bailey.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the funding stream is acceptable. I've heard from the Department of Commerce that they can actually assess a lot more than they do. And in terms of, if you look back into the Reliability Administrator statute, there was another revenue stream of $1 million a year for Ken Wolf to play around with in terms of his work, and they're not nearly using all of that possible revenue stream. And I don't think that this assessment on utilities is very significant in the scheme of all the assessments that they end up paying out for. They basically fund the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. So it's, well, not all the Department of Commerce, but the regulatory intervention part of it.
Representative.
Madam Chair, I serve as Vice Chair of the Regulated Industries Committee, and I want to thank you for bringing this forward because you've given us something else to talk about over there, among other things. But now I get into my feisty part. You know, this is laudable. Anytime we're saving energy and building buildings tighter, stronger, better is a good thing for all of us, irregardless of whatever the public mood and sentiment about other things is at the moment. But you know, I grew up in the coal fields of Pennsylvania. And one of the things we'd find from time to time while paying in the strip mines, which I'm sure is a hazardous occupation these days, is we'd find fossils of palm trees and interesting crustaceans and so on that spoke of a time when central Pennsylvania was very warm and very tropical. Would that have been considered global warming or a warm spot at that time? You don't have to answer that question. I just want you to know that I think about these things. And it seems to me, as I fly over southern Minnesota and I look at this shape of the Minnesota River Valley today and where it was maybe 12,000 years ago, it was a little further south, because I think the last great ice sheet that came down here 7,000 or 8,000 years ago ended somewhere around New Ulm. Certainly Prior Lake, where I live, was scoured out by an ice sheet, which sounds pretty darn cold to me. And the darn thing melted and retreated way back into northern Canada. I guess my rhetorical question is this: what civilization or industry mucked things up to make it get warm and melt the ice sheet after the last ice age? I say all this to say this: is the globe climate changing, getting a little warmer? Yeah, I think it is. I think we all agree with that. How much we have to do with that is something I wish we'd slow down and take a little closer look at. Now again, in the scheme of things, I look at this bill and think, is there any harm being done? I don't think so. I think we're okay with this. Is it actually going to slow down the next ice age? I doubt it. But is it still a good idea to build tight, efficient buildings? Probably. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to vote for the amendment, but not because I'm fearful that the next glacier might be put off by a couple of years.
Okay, other questions for members? I don't know how anybody follows that, so.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry if I sucked all the oxygen out of the room. I didn't mean to do that.
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I appreciate your comments, and I'm grateful that someone spoke up about it. I didn't want to use any air either out of the concerns that you're alluding to, but there is enough left to say that we all don't agree. And I don't even agree the Earth is 12,000 years old. So we'll save that for another amendment.
Oh boy. Okay. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Sally Granz. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I just want to state that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities strives to continually do upgrades and improvements on our buildings. So I just want to state that I'm very pleased with the Representative Johnson for making the alterations that were needed to create guidelines, because the devil really is in the detail, and we are very concerned about the fiscal cost impact that this could have on some of our geographically challenged locations throughout the state. So I just want to state that I'm really pleased that we're sort of slowing this thing down, not like an ice age yet, but enough that we can spend time on it. So we are looking forward to the dialogue that will occur to actually make the difference in the details. So I just want to let you know that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions for this testifier? Okay. Anybody else? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In reading Subdivision 2, and I walked in a little bit late, so I might have missed this part, but we're establishing, we're asking the Department of Administration, Department of Commerce to develop guidelines and procedures for a requirement. So we're not asking them to put the requirement in place, but we're asking for guidelines and procedures for a requirement. And then it says the guidelines are mandatory for all new buildings. Are we actually mandating that they develop guidelines and procedures that would, or are we actually having them develop a requirement? That's my question.
Who wants to take that? Ms. Kane?
Madam Chair, committee members. John Bailey can offer his opinion. I think we were trying to use similar language as was used for the B3 guidelines. And what we would see happening with this assessment is that we would develop protocol for how consultants would determine what the CO2 emissions were. We would continue to track them from the building. And then we would also work with Commerce and Public Utilities Commissions to develop a protocol for doing the energy trading.
Follow-up, Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, again, I guess... So are we establishing a requirement, or is there a requirement that we're just setting new guidelines for, or are we establishing a new requirement that no increases in gases, of which they're going to determine a procedure to figure this out, I assume, but are we establishing a requirement, or are we looking at guidelines and procedures for a requirement that may come?
Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, committee members, the latter, that is how I understand it.
Okay, I guess that's Madam Chair. I guess what I'm troubled by is this is the guidelines under the subject are mandatory for all new buildings receiving funding. If we're doing guidelines for a requirement that doesn't yet exist, how are the guidelines mandatory for all new buildings? You see my confusion, or maybe I'm confused. But.
Good point. Mr. Bailey, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. I think the subdivision 2, it's modeled after Subdivision 1. And in that, there was a process where these guidelines, these sustainable building guidelines, were required. And these guidelines were established. And then at the end of the subdivision, you see that the guidelines established are mandatory. So it creates the directive that the guidelines process be created, and then it says that these guidelines are now mandatory for new bonded buildings after 2008.
So, Representative
Emmer. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, again, I guess the first question I thought I heard you answer is that we're establishing guidelines for requirements that may come. And now I hear you say the guidelines are the requirements. Am I confusing things, or am I still missing something here? I don't know if we're saying that we are going to have greenhouse gas requirements in place as a result of this, or are we saying we're going to look at establishing what the requirements would be so that we can come back and take a look and say, are we going to approve that? In other words, which is it? Are we establishing and saying we're giving them authority to establish guidelines and we're holding all the buildings to it right now? And just whatever they come up with, we're satisfied with, which I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. Or are we establishing, are we asking them to come up with some requirements and procedures, some guidelines and procedures for requirement that we'll get a chance to look at and approve?
The response to the testifiers, then we're going to go to Mr. Shepard. I think part of it ties in with the expiration at the end of the bill. Who wants to respond first?
May I? David Giotti, Madam Chair. I didn't draft the language, and so I understand some of these. As I have taken to understand it from the very first time this came through as the B3 guideline with a 30% more energy efficient than code, that was the requirement. The guidelines are written so that you can prove that somebody has actually met that requirement. And as I would interpret this then, that the requirement that I think is being asked is for the net zero emissions, and the guidelines are so you will know that requirement has been met. That's how the guidelines establish how you demonstrate that the requirement is met. At least that would be my interpretation of the language.
Madam Chair.
Representative Denver.
Do we currently have a requirement that buildings built have to show no net increases in greenhouse gas? Do we have that requirement in place now?
Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, committee members, we do not have the no net gain. What we do have is that as part of the sustainable design guidelines, we ask them to supply us with the CO2 information.
So, Madam Chair, then this is asking us to establish a requirement for no new net increases, and we're asking the administration of Department of Administration and Commerce to give us the guidelines to show how they'll meet that requirement, or what that requirement will be.
Okay.
I think
you want to respond to that? Or
I guess my response would be is it seems to me we're establishing a requirement here on our buildings, and I'm not sure what the requirement is. So we're just saying we're going to require something that they'll figure out, and I don't know if I'm comfortable with that, Madam Chair.
Good point. Mr. Shepard, can you give us a clarification here?
Madam Chair and members, I would tend to agree with the interpretation that Mr. Bailey said and that Representative Demmer just affirmed, which is that the first sentence requires the departments to develop guidelines, and after January 108, those guidelines would be mandatory, so they would become requirements at that point. That's the way I read the existing language here.
And Mr. Shepard, with the tie-in on the back page of the bill with the expiration, maybe you could make comments as it relates to that, Mr. Shepard.
Certainly. Madam Chair, the expiration does not relate to the guidelines. It only relates to a funding source that would be used to develop the guidelines, but the guidelines would not expire under that expiration.
Okay. Representative Demmer, are you considering an oral amendment, or should we come back to you? Let's go to Representative Kahn. We'll come back to you. Representative Kahn.
Conferring with Representative Seifert, so there are two of us at least who think the same thing. He'll jump on me if I misquote him. Guidelines are not substitutes for rules, so a guideline doesn't make something mandatory. I mean, following a guideline is not like following a rule. So I don't know if the sentence is in itself an oxymoron, because you know, you obviously, a guideline means you kind of want to get to there. But it's clearly, it's Representative Seifert said we passed the bill at one point saying that guidelines weren't rules.
In rules.
What?
Okay, was there a question there? Or? Okay, Representative Seifert, at this point.
Yeah, sure, to that point, Representative Johnson, is that your intent, what Representative Kahn just said?
Representative Johnson.
Yes, that would be the intent.
I think
Representative Kahn.
What I think would have to do is you'd have to certainly look at the guidelines, and you'd certainly follow them, but if they're not rules, it's very different. A guideline that isn't a rule is just that. It's a guideline. It means that you should follow. So you can't just ignore it. But it's not.
One of the testifiers, Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm not sure if this helps, but I guess the reason we might use the word guideline is that there's more than one way to accomplish this, and that why the guideline could tell you a number of different ways of reaching this goal.
Okay. Representative Demmer, are you looking at?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still thinking this through. I'm uncomfortable with the idea that we're establishing a requirement, and I have no idea what this requirement might cost the state in terms of new buildings. I have no understanding of what we're actually requiring other than no net increase in greenhouse gas, which I'm not even sure I have a clear definition of what a greenhouse gas is. So I'm not comfortable voting for a requirement to do what I don't know will cost, and I'm not sure what it is. And then we're going to ask the departments to come up with the requirements how to meet that.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines that they come up with are going to be mandatory. So I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm just not comfortable. I don't know if I have enough information. Maybe that's beyond the purview of this meeting, Madam Chair, and somebody else will figure that part out.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I slightly even agree with Representative Demmer, just because just because of the kind of oxymoron of the statement saying that guidelines are mandatory. So I think that sentence wants to be rephrased so that all new buildings, all new buildings receiving funding from the bond proceeds funds after January 1st, 2008, shall look at the guideline, shall consider these guidelines in it. And if the guidelines themselves are mandatory, and we obviously want to, you might want to report to the legislature in 2007.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, I would be happy to work to develop language, but I think there's a couple of different ideas going on, and whatever the committee would like, I think I can draft something, but I'm not sure exactly what direction you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what I'm understanding is the intent, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think my understanding of the intent after this discussion is we are saying that we are not going to allow any new buildings with state funding to be built unless they have no net increase in greenhouse gases. And we're asking these departments to establish the guidelines under which to show that that's true. Now, I don't know if that's not wording, but statute, but is that the essence of what we're trying to do here? We're establishing the fact that no new buildings will be built that increase greenhouse gases, that's affirmative, and we're asking the department to develop guidelines and procedures for objectively defining what new greenhouse gas is.
Representative Johnson.
Well, I think it kind of overstates it in a negative way. It's more to the point that, new state buildings aren't going to be prohibited from being built. They're going to be built, but they're going to be following the guidelines of no net increase in greenhouse gas emissions. It's not that there's not going to be any new state building, but we're going to try to build them in as efficient and effective way as possible to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
I'm going to make a chair decision here. Let's lay the bill over temporarily. Representative Demmer, if you could talk to Representative Mr. Shepard, and we're going to take up the next bill, and then we'll come back to that bill if you've got an oral amendment worked out at that time. So maybe you can go in the hall and talk about that for 10 minutes or something. We'll come back to this bill. So this bill is temporarily laid over.
So Madam Chair, you're sending us out to the hall.
I don't know.
Well, wherever you need to go. Okay, we're going to take up Representative Beard's bill, and then we're going to come back to Representative Johnson's bill if we've got some kind of oral amendment figured out there. Okay, Representative Beard, would you like to move your bill, please?
Madam Chair and members, I would like to move House Bill 3391. Recommend it to pass and be referred, I believe, to the General Register this time.
Okay, that is your motion. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'd like to call Remy Stone or Peter Coyle, either one, to the witness stand to talk about the bill. I've got to tell you, I'm not sure why it's here, members. We did hear at local government where we added a delete all amendment that removed some requirements. So what you're looking at here, the first engrossment, 3391-1, is the bill as it's been amended, which merely adds watershed district review and soil and water conservation district review to existing state statute regarding timelines for plan approvals for developers and building permits. I was thinking that there was a task force that was established, but there is not. That was talked about and was not put in the delete all amendment out of local government. And so you're welcome to ask any questions you'd like about the bill, members, but there is no task force, I'm sorry to say, and there is just adding watershed districts and the Bowser districts to the timeline requirements for building permit turnarounds. I should point out, too, that the bill summary you're looking at in your packet is actually dated March 23rd and refers to the original bill introduction. It does not refer to the updated first engrossment that includes the delete all amendment. If there are any further questions about the bill, I do have Ms. Remy Stone here, who speaks for the Builders and Building and Trade Council of Twin Cities. I would be happy to
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, could you just please, or your testifier, just review what do the watersheds and the Soil Water Conservation District currently go by for rules as far as when they have to have their... zoning permit side.
Ms. Stone, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Remy Stone. I'm with the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. To answer Representative Welty's question, Watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts often engage in additional land use review to make sure that what we're doing is consistent with their permitting. It's all over the board. Most of these political subdivisions do operate within the 60-day to 120-day time frame. We do find periodically that in their rules they'll try and stretch it to 6 months, you know, or 180 days, those kinds of things. And since they are political subdivisions and these are those kinds of permits, we want to make it clear that they fit within the law.
And Madam Chair, if I may add, Representative Welty, usually their plans where a developer is working a subdivision and has to handle stormwater runoff that's going into a drainage system that a soil and water watershed district responsible for, and they need to review those plans and make sure everything is according to Hoyle. And so that, practically speaking, that's what we're involved with here.
Paula, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Baird. To what degree is this just, you know, development tends to be clustered in certain expanding areas, and that they're just overwhelmed, and that there's no way that they have a revenue source that in a fast, quickly growing area they can hire enough qualified staff to actually keep up with the volume? Because I suspect, you know, it sounds like most are making a good faith attempt and able to, but, you know, these are pretty small little units of government with pretty limited funding, and I'm wondering whether or not, you know, if you're the new exurb, you're in the area that's just been opened by the Met Council for Development, and you've got a lot of people waiting to, you know, pop a lot of things into the ground, that, you know, this may not be realistic unless you also deal with the issue of additional revenues, perhaps from the development, from some other source to actually enable them to do it. Because I don't think we should be putting in requirements that it's impossible for someone to do. And I do think that we want to make sure that, you know, our watershed protection laws are followed and taken seriously. But I'm wondering whether or not this is solving a problem from one part of the equation, but it doesn't solve it for the other side.
Madam Chair, I think perhaps Ms. Stone can speak better to that than I could, although I have a few thoughts on that. But.
Okay, Ms. Stone.
Certainly. Boy, we could go through a whole story about how environmental laws are complied with in development, but the long and short is that most of the entities that are issuing permits are very much like Minnehaha Watershed District. Scott County Soil and Water Conservation are very large entities that have revenue streams, political subdivisions that have attaching authority. If they're issuing these permits, they need that additional staff to turn it around in time. We certainly welcome them to embed it into the fee, quite frankly, because time is money in these situations. We have not found, in fact, we've run this by the Watershed District Association folks. They have not objected. The League of Minnesota Cities, of course, works through this bill with us, and they're supporting the bill. We've not heard from any watershed districts or soil and conservation districts that are opposed. In fact, the EQB worked with us carefully to make sure that we define this to meet just the local situations, not the EAWEIS or EAWEIS rules that certainly do take a very, very long time.
Madam Chair, we do have Mr. Ray Bone, who's the state spokesperson for the Boards of Watershed, Soil and Water and Watershed, if you'd like him to speak to this also.
Bone, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ray Bone. I'm here today representing Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. We have sent this legislation past our watershed districts, and frankly, I think most of them believe that they already were under this legislation as it's presently written. So we don't perceive any major problems with this legislation.
Okay. Any questions from members? All right. Thank you. And is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Beard, you get the last word before we vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Like I said, I'm not sure why it came to this committee, but this is such a happy little committee. I'm glad it did, and I'd encourage your support passing it to the general register. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beard renews his motion that House File 3391 be recommended to pass the general register. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and bill goes to general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, I see that they're still discussing out in the hall, so let's go to the next bill. And actually, Representative Neil Peterson, if you could take the chair at this time.
Yes. Yep.
Oh, hi there. Great. Thank you. Okay.
While Representative Finkelstein is getting ready, I was called out of the room for an early childhood group from Edina. There must have been 40 preschoolers out there with their moms. And I said to them, I have to get back in here because Representative Finkelstein is offering a bill dealing with trafficking. And they all said, get back in there. That is very important. Representative Finkelstein, if you'd present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move that House File 3244 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety Finance. And, Mr. Chair and members, I do have a oral amendment. Mr. Shepherd has that, and this is to incorporate some changes as related to the Senate bill, which met first deadline. Okay.
Please.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Tinglestead's amendment would be as follows. On page 4, line 35, before the word the, insert a representative of. So it would be parallel to some of the other clauses and refer to a representative of the Attorney General. On page 5, line 6, would delete the word and at the end of the sentence. And then after line 6, insert parentheses 14, a representative of the United States Attorney Office, semicolon, and then we'd renumber the next
clause. Would you repeat that again?
A representative of the United States Attorney Office, semicolon, and.
Okay. Any more?
And then, Mr. Chair, the next clause would be renumbered, so what's now clause 14 on line 5.7 would be clause 15.
Okay. Everybody have that? Any questions? Okay, we have the bill as amended.
Well, actually, let's just move that amendment and just make a quick vote on it.
Okay, let's move the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, is carried. And to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate coming before you here today. This has been the year of task force groups here in GovOps. So, in fact, I had discussion with some folks last night about the number of task force bills that we've been seeing, and we think maybe it relates somewhat to last year's special session and people thinking creatively about how to solve problems and involving more people from the community in some of the complex issues that we have before the legislature. And I think next year in GovOps we'll have some more discussions about task force. And I understand there's usually a typical number of people that are on a task force, and we had a little bit of a review on this last year, but just any of the committee members that may be serving on GovOps again next year, I think task force may be an issue that we'll do more work on as it becomes more of a discussion item here in the legislature. Today is, you have before you the Human Trafficking Task Force group, and this relates to some of the work I've done in the last couple of years with organizations around the country. There's an effort with women legislators to deal with issues related to sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And some people will tell you that the sex trafficking industry is bigger than drug trafficking, and there's potentially more money being made in that industry. So we put some good laws in place over the last year, and this is kind of a follow-up to that. And I know legislators around the country are looking at related laws to do more things related to this issue. And also, real active in our community is the College of St. Catherine. They've had several different conferences. I know there's another one coming up, too. And trying to get more information out about this and kind of develop a coalition. You've been seeing some things in the news about this, too. And this bill is actually been in public safety. It's going back there now. But we wanted to look at the task force section of it. And I have two testifiers here with me today, and I know there's a couple of handouts that have come around as well. Linda Miller from Civil Society and Diane Cushman from the Women's Economic LCC, Legislative Commission. So with that, maybe if Ms. Miller could make some comments, and then we'll come back to questions on the task force, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm Linda Miller, and I'm the Executive Director of Civil Society. We're a nonprofit that I founded 10 years ago. I'm an attorney. I graduated with Senator Neville 30 years ago from William Mitchell. Civil Society has received the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services grant with Breaking Free for aiding and reaching out to trafficking victims, as well as the Department of Justice grant in the United States, the DOJ, to provide services to the victims of international trafficking. We started with that second, the first grant, and I think before you in your packet, you have the results of 10 months of that first grant with, under the U.S. Health and Human Services grant. This is from the Star Trib, and they put it into a chart form, so that was very nice of them. And it shows that the internationally trafficked victims that we've received are from around the world, and also shows that the a major portion of them are both sex and labor trafficked. We have had, we've continued to receive human trafficked victims, and so now, as a result of that one grant, we have 32 internationally trafficked victims that we're serving, and among them they have 17 children. Also, as a part of the grant, we started the Minnesota Human Trafficking Watch, and we had our first meeting in March 3rd. And since that, we've had requests around the state for trainings. We have 21 trainings scheduled. We are going to Perham Rotary. Crookston got a grant to have us come for a full day of training. We went to United Methodist Women's Annual Conference in St. Cloud. We were at Mankato yesterday, and they had that on television, local television in Mankato. We have gone down to speak to any number of groups all around the state. And I can tell you that this is snowballing. We went to the Minnesota Social Services Association to speak last Thursday, and about 225 packed into that room. They were sitting on the floor, they were standing, and they finally had to close the doors and not allow anyone else in. So this is really, really a concern of the state as they gradually realize that we've been designated as among the 13 most trafficked states in the United States. So, you know, we have two federal grants. Thank goodness, because we have lots of clients to serve and lots of work to do. And I would urge the state to get involved, and I think that this bill really, really shows the emphasis of the state to solve this problem.
Thank you. Would you repeat that one statistic again? You said we are one of the...
Yeah, we were designated by former Attorney General Ashcroft as one of the 13 most trafficked states.
Wow. Any questions for Ms. Miller? Beer?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know that we have a high degree of immigration and refugee population here, mostly because we have some of the world's most outstanding refugee organizations like World Vision and Lutheran Social Service and so on. Is that perhaps why we're one of the highest concentrated, because we have so many folks coming here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, most of the people that are coming through those marvelous organizations are refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rare that refugees are trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
We do have two cases among those 32 where they are refugees. When they get here, they're refugee status.
Mm-hmm.
But that's unrelated to the trafficking, because the trafficked victims, actually the sex trafficked victims, come in on visas which are on the state's legal,
mm-hmm.
generally. And the children come in with someone and on the face with a visa that is on the face legal. So they are not of refugee status.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Ma'am, it's helpful for us to know how it works, how they get here. You know, they're being smuggled in ocean containers. But what you're saying is they're coming here legally on the face of it, but then are being coerced, intimidated, deceived, or something into slavery of some sort or another then.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. The labor trafficked victims tend to more come over the borders.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dempsey, did you have a question, sir?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was reading the report on this particular bill, and it says the 10-year felony applies if the crime involves a victim under the age of 18. Other offenses carry a 5-year felony. Can you explain to me why we have 10 years for a felony and then just because of age it lessens?
Representative Tingle said, were you going to walk through the elements of the bill, and do you want to come back to that question, or do you want to deal with it now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps my testifier, Ms. Miller, has a response, but, you know, this bill has been in public safety and is going back to public safety, so, you know, I was hoping we could look at the task force questions, but maybe if we could have Ms. Miller respond to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm just looking at this. It looks like this is a new 10-year felony for illegal use of documents. And then that applies if the victim is under the age of 18. So that other offenses that would apply to adults would carry the 5-year felony.
Okay. Ms. Cushman, I think you're...
Mr. Chair and Representative Dempsey, Diane Cushman from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. It was just last year that the legislature implemented these penalties for human trafficking. And it was both the legislators as well as the governor who chose to up those penalties 1 year later to reflect the particular vulnerability of the children who are trafficked. So that the for labor trafficking in minors, it's a 20-year felony rather than 15 years for trafficking in people over 18. And when somebody confiscates documents or takes your immigration papers and threatens you, that goes from a 5-year penalty if you're doing that for a victim who's over 18 and 10 years for under. So it's just a reflection of people's perception that this is a really bad crime, and especially when it involves children. So, and since it was just implemented last year, this year it's going up 5 years in those two cases.
Okay,
thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody wishing to be heard? Representative Fiedelstedt, you want to renew
your
motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just was hoping that you would take a look at the task force group that starts on page 4 there. And, we have representatives from various organizations. And I didn't know if there's somebody here at Comets or something. I know that Public Safety has looked at this. And, we're looking
that
at
that. Somebody may not be here.
Okay. So I stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Our apologies as a committee for being so stunned that this even goes on. I guess we just got to hear a little more about the whole thing rather than just do our work and focus on the task force. But thank you for trying to bring us back. I noticed that, just to my casual reading, it looks like it's a pretty complete and extensive task force that would understand the scope of the problem and make recommendations on for prevention or amelioration or what have you. There's an effective date when it begins, but is this going to go on in perpetuity? Do we think we want to add a sunset in there 10 years out, or what do you think? Or is there a sunset and I'm missing it?
Who's going to respond to that question? Mr. Shepard, are you going to?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard and members, the bill on page 6, line 7, has a 2011 sunset for the task force right now.
6, line 7?
Page 6, line 7.
7,
I believe.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, there, okay. Yeah, line 6 and 7. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We should probably hurry along. It is 11:36 or so. We're due for a fire alarm to go off any minute.
The right of spring.
There's no controversy here.
Okay. I had Mr. Wardlow next. Mr. Representative Baird, do we get...
We get it. There is. It's there. Actually, Mr. Chair and members, it jumps between line 6 and line 7. It's not easy. It doesn't jump right out at you, but it is there. Thank you.
Representative Wardlow and then Representative Lockton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for whichever wants to answer. How does Minnesota compare with other states as far as controlling and regulating this problem?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow, what I can tell you is that Minnesota is one of the in the top 10 of implementing legislation to address human trafficking. And I think the fact that we've already received $950,000 in federal grants to address the issue. And just to speak on behalf of Linda Miller, Executive Director of Civil Society, really there are 32 regions, and it may be a region, maybe just, I think California has 3 of these grants, so a region can be within a state. Minnesota has found the most trafficking victims of anybody else who's received this grant. And in part it's because civil society as an organization already had set up legal clinics in areas around the Twin Cities in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the counties where to try to identify victims of underreported and unreported crime. And so what we've learned is that victims of trafficking rarely go to law enforcement. The countries they're from, they're afraid of their law enforcement officials. And so to find them is like trying to find a needle in a haystack, literally, which is why the reports of the number of victims countrywide vary from 20,000 to 100,000. But I think Minnesota is once again a leader in this field because we've had some systems in place already that we leveraged to identify these victims. And we also have been very smart about using the resources that we have, and the agencies that exist have been working together. Thank you.
Follow-up?
That question was in no way to imply that we should be against this bill for that reason. I'd like to see that we're being proactive and trying to maintain our status is maybe be number one, I guess.
Mr. Chair and members, I know that public safety is looking at this bill and the task force part of it as well, and I know that that Representative Johnson sounds like they have some kind of an oral amendment they're ready on their bill, so I don't know if we can quickly finish up this and then we'll go back to that bill perhaps.
I think I have a question, Representative Glockner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Tingle said, I note that we have language in the bill on page 5, subdivision 4, that designates the establishment of a coordinator position and outlines, you know, some responsibilities, and I've kind of two questions about that. One, it doesn't seem like good practice, but I'm not sure, maybe it is, to put in statute a direction for a particular position. I know you have an appropriation, which, you know, would cover that, but it seems like, you know, if it would be delightful if, you know, 15 years as a result of this activity, we decided that we'd really had it under control and local law enforcement had it as a priority, we didn't need this. I don't know if whoever was Commissioner of Public Safety at that time or whoever's in the Department of Finance would actually remember there was something in statute about a particular position, and so I'm kind of wondering why we would put that in as opposed to just, you know, handling it through the normal appropriation process.
Representative
Tingleton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, we're checking into that right now. I'll be working with Chairman Smith and Public Safety Finance about some of the issues, especially as it relates to appropriations.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and my other concern is I just would see that if it's going to be an ongoing position, I would prefer that it be a classified position and not be some, I mean, hopefully we'll hire someone who has some experience and expertise out of the types of groups that you list in the task force, and I just assume they continue on and not have it be something that changes over with the change of an administration.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Loeffler, Mr. Chair, that's a good point. We'll look at that.
Any other questions? Would you like to renew your motion, please? And we'll deal with this and we'll call back.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3244, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety Finance.
Understanding the motion, are you ready to vote?
Yes.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members. And then if we could bring Sheldon Johnson back up. I'll come back in the chair and see how far we get through the next bill then. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chairman and members, the Trump group, considering of Johnson and Demmer and all kinds of other people, I think has a resolution that's agreeable to everyone, and that's contained in the amendment with the, of course, terrific assistance of Mark Shepard, who knew how to put it in words that made sense.
Okay. Representative Conn, we're going to officially bring Representative Sheldon Johnson's bill back up, House File 3139. Representative Conn.
Okay, and I'd like to move the amendment that's being passed out now. It's an amendment to the Delete Everything Amendment, and it's written on, or whatever, however you want to do it, make this amendment be the Delete Everything Amendment. But the what this is putting in the procedure that Randy wanted, where you report to the legislature, and the groups thought they could maybe do it by March, March 15th, 07, on the guidelines and procedures, and then the legislature will determine if the guidelines established under this, if guidelines established under this subdivision will be mandatory for all new buildings receiving funding from the bond proceeds fund after January 1st, 2008. And we had a discussion that process will tell us maybe the 2008 should be a different year, maybe they decide it wouldn't. You know, maybe they'll report something and say they need more time to work on it. But before any mandatory part of it takes place, the legislature will see it again.
Okay.
And in fact, in fact, the legislature will have to make a positive determination that they should be mandatory.
Good.
Okay, so we're going to officially code this as the Conn oral amendment to the DE1 amendment. And any discussion? Do people understand this one? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to express appreciation to Representative Sheldon Johnson and the folks that he's working with. It was nice to work this out, and I feel more comfortable.
Good. Other questions or comments? Representative Johnson, you like this?
Yeah, let's appreciate the cooperation of Representative Demmer and others in working something out.
Okay, let's get a vote on this, and then I'll see if there's anybody else in the audience. Okay, to the Kahn Amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of that? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and that motion is that amendment is adopted. Thank you. Okay, so now the bill is before us as amended. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against it? Okay. And with that, then Representative Sheldon Johnson renews his motion that House File 3139, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Regulated Industries Committee. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and bill is going to Regulated Industries.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank
you. Okay. And now we go to the last item on the agenda, and I'll have Representative Neil Peterson come forward again, please. And how many? I know we have a few amendments we're looking at on this one. Six amendments. We'll maybe get through a couple of them or so. And then we'll continue. We'll lay this bill over then for next Tuesday for further development. So before I move here, I'm just going to say that Chair will move that House File 3781 be brought up before us, and that for consideration of amendments, and that before we adjourn, then we'll be laying the bill over. Okay?
Representative Loeffler, Representative Baer.
Mr. Chair and members,
I'm trying to get your partner up there. With
okay, good. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. This was the bill we looked at last week. I know we've had a lot of meetings lately, and we had actually taken this comprehensive bill and broken it into three separate bills, which we've moved out to other committees now. And this is the more comprehensive bill. And as you recall, one day we passed around the Green Jackets in committee, and I know many of you are co-authors on this legislation, and I appreciate you doing that. And so we thought today we would take the opportunity to perhaps look at some other issues related to legislative reform that we might consider in this more comprehensive package. So Representative Loeffler and I have been working on this issue basically since special session last year. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Representative Loeffler for some more background, and then probably be appropriate at that time to take a look at the amendment.
Great. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, life is an adventure. I just didn't expect to be up here. I'm quite sure. I think that most of the committee has a pretty good idea of where these ideas came from. And the original base bill that we're working from is the one that emerged out of the ideas that came through the legislative reform idea collecting that we did, that resulted in 50 ideas being ranked by all of our peers. And to that base, the ideas of some others that weren't part of that survey apparently are going to be before us to consider.
Okay. Thank you. How do you wish to proceed?
Well, let me just give a brief highlight. I think you do have the House Research Bill summary on it, and then start looking at a couple of the amendments. We'll go till we run out of time, then we'll lay it over and finish it up Tuesday. Okay. So basically, if you want to just pull out your bill summary on this House File 3781 talks about the legislative forums in Section 1, some additional training for legislators, looking at the schedule for consideration of legislation in Section 2, so we have kind of a more timely structure as things move through the legislative session, and putting some things in statute that have just been kind of procedural things informally. in Section 3 on the contents of the budget bills, so that things move a little bit more efficiently and effectively. There's not confusion about that. And Section 4, expenses of governor-elect, and that relates to the transition after election of a governor, so that legislation can be developed and start moving into the legislative session more quickly, so that we don't have such a time crunch at the end of the session. And I know in the 10 years that I've been here, I've seen, you know, my freshman year, a lot of the legislation came through, you know, early to mid to late January, and now we're seeing agency bills introduced as late as mid-March. And I know when we're trying to complete our work here by the end of April or mid-May, there's definitely a time crunch with so many bills coming through, let alone the stress and pressure we're putting on our reviser and our health research with processing bills so quickly. So with that, let's go to amendments.
You want amendments?
I know that Representative Hodge has at least a couple. Representative Hodge.
Representative Hodge, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was an A1 amendment in the packet, but that is not my intention. So I would like to discuss the A2 amendment.
Okay, let's call the A2 amendment. I looked at them, and they almost looked like they were counterproductive, A1 and 2. Let's do A2 amendment. Is this yours, Representative Hodge?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment, mainly what it does is put the responsibility back onto the legislator that if we have an impasse when it comes to passing our budget bills, it would require that the full legislator in each body vote on the outstanding budget bills that haven't been passed on the last day of regular session. And if we continue on into special session, it would require that the legislator, both bodies, vote in full on every single day on the outstanding budget bills. This is kind of the result that we had last year from the attempts by Representative Olson to have the body act. And I think this just adds transparency and a level of responsibility onto the legislative bodies, in which people will then be able to, I don't want to say point the finger, but be able to place that responsibility on each one of us as we are everybody's elected representatives, instead of having the confusion of blaming a few people in conference committee or a few of our leaders. This puts the responsibility in our hands. I would like to move the A2 amendment.
A2 amendment. So, again, if they're voting every day.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it would be every day in special session. During regular session, this would only come into effect the last day. That if the budget bills are not passed yet, that those outstanding issues come before us.
Okay. Reaction to the amendment. I see a hand from Representative Baird.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Posh, I'm thinking about the practicality of how this works. So let me just paint a picture for you and tell me how you think this would be. Suppose we've had conference committee reports come back between Senate and House, and we've agreed on a couple things, but let's say education finance has not been agreed to. So we have a House position, we have a Senate position. What are we going to vote on? Do we throw them both up and see which one wins? And does the Senate do the same thing? Or tell me, in that scenario, that's one I know we get hung up on. Just for example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beard, I think that's a good question. We are just focused on the education finance bill, and it wouldn't be a pretty smooth process. You know, we would be voting on the budget bills in the House and then sending our report over to the Senate, and they would have to accept it or reject it. And I could anticipate a back-and-forth process, but it may be that back-and-forth process is exactly what we need to deal with the issues.
So to follow up then, Mr. Chair, would the Senate be able to vote on theirs and send it to us also, or would we just deal with House sending stuff to the Senate to concur or what have you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Beard. I would, it's my understanding and intention that it would be both the House and the Senate could send over their bills, and that this would require full action by each body to try to hopefully slowly chip away at a compromise. So if we were to receive a report from the Senate and you know, we like certain things, we didn't like certain things, we could do minor changes and send it back to the Senate and see what they think. Like I said, it probably won't be a pretty process. It's like making sausage. You know, that we talked about. But at least the public's going to know what's happened and where their elected representatives are voting on the issues. Right now, I just find it very frustrating, and also the public finds it frustrating, that 190-some of us are sitting there and twiddling our thumbs when a few people are making the decisions in the back room.
Ron Burns, so. Okay.
Well, that's okay. Enough for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn, please.
Well, actually, this is a little bit like something, and my seatmate tells me that actually Representative McElroy and I agreed on, which I wouldn't have believed if he hadn't told me. But it's what some other states, it's the kind of thing that some other states do, including New York State does. And we don't think you can do it without a constitutional amendment, because we decide, you know, we say that each person has to vote on the same bill, and we have ways in which they go back and forth, and I don't think you could simply do it with this paragraph. But this is what I would have liked to see it, and done for what New York State does, and I don't know if they've changed it. It's called the shuttle system, which is the bill goes, you know, we can't amend a bill after it's come back from another. We just can concur or send it to conference committee. Then the bill comes, and they work on the bill, and then they so they can make amendments. They make amendments in it, and then they send it off back again, and then, you know, the same thing happens. Now, it's interesting, and I don't know what New York did. I don't know if they went to conference committees. This was considered to... where I liked it coming in is, I think, in some small, easy bills. When there's an agreement, then you still have to go through the whole mess of conference committee. It seemed that this would be something where you could much more quickly do the... you know, much more quickly get the agreement that if there was some way to do it. Now, Marty tells me we need a constitutional amendment to do that. We'd have to look to see if you could... But the problem is, the interesting thing was that the comment against it in New York State was that it was an anti-democratic thing, was that conference committees were inherently more democratic because the shuttle system ended up with just the two people, the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the Senate, making the final decision on the bill. And it was not, you know, and so, you know, my major objection to this is that it can't work with this simple, I don't see how it can work with this simple language in it. I mean, I think there are statutory problems, maybe even constitutional problems, and so forth. So I'd rather not pass this until it's something that, you know, that could work.
Thank you. I have Representative Demmer and then Representative Olson.
Okay.
Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Posh, for bringing this forward. This is definitely tracking with issues that have been raised in a number of ways, and as you noted, issues that we raised last year in the special session. And Representative Kahn, I'm not real clear on how this could be raised constitutional issues, but I just want to point out that Subdivision 1 is really the operative part of this amendment. While you can argue there's some things here that are not real clear, I forget the term you used, Representative Kahn, but we called it the ping pong effect, that it's not clear that this intends to create the ping pong effect where the rules would have to comply with this action by creating the ability for the House to send the bill to the Senate and the Senate to simultaneously send the bill to a House, and each body that receives it could amend it and send it back. The operative part of this is Subdivision 1. If I'm looking for a way I could just very quickly put in a provision so that either body could amend once they receive it, mm-hmm. and it creates more ability for communication, for action, for potential action in the last hour, because it creates flexibility. One of the other bodies, let's say both bodies decide we're going to be the first one out of the chute and we're going to pass the omnibus bill to the other body, and those two bills pass. So each body has... the Senate would have a House file, the House would have a Senate file. If we allow them to amend, one of the bodies could come up with an agreement that the other body would accept. let's say the Senate amended it in a way the House wouldn't accept it, but the House amended the Senate bill in a way that the Senate would accept it, you'd have an agreement and you'd end the session. That's what could come from this, but it could use some language to make that very, very clear. I would argue that the existing language could allow for that, but it isn't absolutely clear that it be permitted to amend, only because current rules do not permit that. But this is creating a new rule, so you could also argue for that effect. Hopefully that's clear.
Representative Olson, we were planning at some point to lay this over until Tuesday. So, given the wishes of this committee, we could act on this amendment, or we could lay this over until Tuesday, and you can collaborate with whomever and make some suggestions on Tuesday that would work.
We may have a statement right now, and this is Representative Hosh is the author of this, and I mean all due respect to him, but if Representative Hosh concurs with the concerns I just raised, mm-hmm. Council has an idea if you want to deal with it now.
My question to the author, given the time, do you want to start voting on some of these amendments, or do you want to discuss them and then take them to Tuesday with your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, looking at the time, I'm thinking it's perhaps better if we lay this over until Tuesday, and then some of the issues that have just been brought up, we can perhaps have a resolution at that time.
Right. And then at that point, we'll find that somebody who wants to claim the A1.
Yeah, I think I'm going to claim that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that is yours. Okay. You want to hold that until Tuesday, or do you...
Sure. Then we can do all the amendments all in one day.
Yeah. And at least that way we can discuss them at the same time. In other words, the four-day recess might have us create this path all over again. Is that...
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to lay my bill over then for consideration on Tuesday. Then before we have the meeting adjourned here, can I just make a couple announcements from the testifying stand, please? We have a new staff member on our committee here, Jason Fossum. Jason, if you could stand up, GOP caucus research person, kind of equal to Brad Kelly from the DFL, and many people know that Bob Shipman has been the person for our committee, and he has moved on to state government finance with Chairman Marty Seifert. And Jason, maybe if you could just stand up and just say a few words. Where are you coming from? What's your background? Just 30 seconds.
My background, I was serving with the Republican caucus in 2003 as legislative assistant. I was doing that for 2.5 years and went to constituent services, and now I'm in the...
Welcome. Okay. And then I know we've had a card going around the table here and snacks and cookies, and today is our last committee meeting with our committee administrator, Scott Neske. So, Scott, why don't you tell us where you're going?
Starting on Monday, I'll be government relations with State Lottery.
Okay, let's thank Scott for his part. There's a card that's gone around, so thanks everybody for signing that. So,
free lottery ticket?
Yeah.
I get free lottery. Until you win.
Just one more quick thing, Mr. Chair. Member, okay. So our next meeting will be Tuesday morning, and watch for information about a committee dinner that night. We might be doing a joint dinner with the Senate committee. So we could probably adjourn at this time.
Okay, we are adjourned.